KPCW News Time now, 8:10. The Snyderville Basin Planning Commission meeting in regular session tomorrow, starting at 4:30 at the Sheldon Richens Auditorium. On the phone with a preview of the agenda, I have Summit County Planner Jennifer Strader. We hope to be joined by Ray Milliner later. Good morning, Jennifer.
Good morning.
So the first two items in the colony, a two-lot application and a four-lot, staff recommending approval. If this is being handled by Planner Amir Koss, but could you comment if this is going to have any ridgeline impacts? Or,
you know, unfortunately, I can't comment on those applications. I'm just not familiar enough with those.
Sure. Next is the major item. It's a requested amendment for the Silver Creek Village project. The applicant, backed up by Scott Loomis of Mountainlands Community Housing Trust, disagrees with the staff. The proposal is that rather than spread out the construction of workforce housing over the build-out of the project, that the developer would donate five parcels to Mountainlands Community Housing, and on those parcels would be concentrated some 283 workforce units out of the 330 that were part of the original approval, and that they would be front-loaded rather than built over time. So why is staff recommending against this?
Well, let me start by saying that the development of affordable housing is a goal of the county council, and it is absolutely a necessity. However, equally as important as simply building the units is ensuring that the design and function of the units result in a desirable living situation. We have yet to see plans that accomplish this. So when the development agreement was being reviewed, the integration of affordable housing was discussed, it was scrutinized, and language was thoughtfully crafted so that not only would the units be integrated, but by doing so, this would encourage a variety of unit sizes, types, designs, prices, et cetera. So, you know, at this point, we have about, I want to say we have four subdivision applications that have been turned in for different parcels in Silver Creek. And they're not proposing any affordable housing. But if they did, let's just say that each of these subdivision applications proposed 35% affordable housing. Now, 35% of the first 271 units are supposed to be affordable units. So if each of these provided 35%, you'd end up with, I think it was something like 84 or 85 units, which would be spread out, integrated, and it would meet the requirements of the development agreement without the need for an amendment. So that's kind of where staff is on this right now.
So it's not that you're concerned that not only are you afraid of just having them be kind of cookie cutter units, but that they're separated from the rest of the development?
Absolutely. Yep, they're separated from the rest of the development.
So I guess what's wrong with that? Because it certainly has worked okay in some Park City neighborhoods, like we've got Silver Meadows. I mean, it's surrounded by the Prospector neighborhood. And then we have Snow Creek, which is surrounded by market price condominiums there in Park Meadows. So it has worked, but that's not what you want?
Well, I think that's going to be a discussion that the public needs to weigh in on and the Planning Commission needs to weigh in on. I think you're right that it has worked, but I think when this development agreement was being reviewed, that just wasn't what was represented that this development would be. You know, they had talked about making sure that there would be a mix of units. So there would be single-family homes. There would be units above the commercial development. You know, they would have condominiums, townhomes, a variety of different types and sizes of units so that it would allow for diversity and, you know, more people. You know, if you've got maybe a larger family that wanted to live in a single family home, that would work. If you have someone who's single and wants to live above the commercial units, that would work for them. So I think that it may work, but I think that this development was not intended to be that. And so that's why we would like to hear from the public and see what the Planning Commission says about it.
Sure. Scott Loomis and the developers say, of course, a critical need for affordable housing. And they believe it could be endangered if the county doesn't approve this amendment, saying that it could take as long as 15 years for those workforce units to be built out. But I guess I think what I hear you saying from the planning staff is that, you know what, that might be okay to get what we want.
Well, it might be okay to get what we want and to make sure that the units are desirable units to live in. We just haven't seen a plan that fits the units on the parcel in a manner that actually works when you take into account the setback requirements, the height requirements. By doing this, it may require that future amendments have to be made to the development agreement, because I think the second part of the discussion is not just are they, you know, they're asking to have the units front-loaded, but the proposed language fails to clarify other parts of the affordable housing requirements that are in the agreement. So what will end up is there's requirements for the development that aren't going to be clear and predictable and will likely cause confusion for future developments. And like I said, it may even result in further amendments to the development agreement being proposed.
There is a height amendment that's being requested. Is there a staff recommendation on that?
Well, there is a height recommendation for one of the parcels. They're requesting to go from 32 feet to, I think it's 36 feet. And we don't have, I guess we've recommended denial on that as well, because we don't know why that request is being made. We haven't seen a plan that indicates why they need that height amendment. So at this point, we just don't really have any way to, evaluate that.
Okay. Let's see. There will be more discussion about Peter Caroon's project on Rasmussen Road. It's a market residential affordable housing and commercial development. Do we know any more if this project would be affected by UDOT's possible plans for an interchange there, which could require part of the site?
Well, we understand that it's in UDOT's long-range plan, but exactly what that long-range plan is, it could be a 20-year plan, and what we've been told is that they don't have funding for, UDOT doesn't have funding for these future, I guess it's a future interchange there at that location, but if they did move forward with that, if UDOT moved forward with that, then it definitely could impact, the west portion of this parcel. And so on that area of the property, they are proposing 24 temporary units, their cabins, that could be moved in the future if future improvements needed to be made to Rasmussen Road. But we just don't know what the timing of that might be.
How much affordable housing are we talking here? Because the Planning Commission had previously discussed if those units could be reserved first for local employees.
Right. So right now they're proposing it's 108 units that are spread out through 7 apartment buildings plus the 24 cabins. But the applicant is saying at least 40% of those apartment units would be affordable. So if you just take at least 40% being affordable, you end up with 65 market units and then 43 deed restricted units. But then when you have to take into account what the development code requires for a market project. So the development code requires 20% to be affordable. So when you figure out the math, you basically end up with an additional approximately 29 units that would be over and above the 20% that's required that they're proposing to be deed restricted. So I think the question for the Planning Commission is whether or not those additional 29 units satisfy a compelling countervailing public interest that is required per the general plan.
All right. What is the proposed commercial for?
You know, we're not sure of the uses, but it's 8,200 square feet of neighborhood commercial uses, but we haven't been told exactly what those uses are yet.
Okay. Jennifer, anything you wanted to add before I turn to Ray?
I don't think so. I don't think so. That's it.
All right. Thanks for your time. And Ray Milliner, another discussion will be on the Woodward Gorgoza Fieldhouse tomorrow night.
Yeah. Can you hear me?
Yeah. Okay. So the question was, there will be another discussion on the Woodward Gorgoza Fieldhouse?
Yeah. The applicants at the last public hearing or work session that we had with the Planning Commission, they expressed a number of concerns relating to the location of the building, the design of the building, and the setbacks from streams and wetlands. The applicant has taken a couple of months and worked on those issues. He's come back with some new designs He's modified the building a little bit. He's put a little bit more interest into the building, changed up the colors. He's given them some exhibits showing what would happen if it were placed in a different location. And also, he's been working on the stream setbacks. He's going to actually apply for a variance for that. And so this work session will be to present the new drawings and the new look of the building to the Planning Commission and get additional feedback.
Yeah, are you happy with what you see?
I believe it's an improvement over what they have had. So I think that the applicant is definitely moving in the right direction.
Okay, and as we know, this came to the county council prior to going to the Planning Commission, basically to give them the increased height exception that they needed?
Yeah, the applicant applied for a special exception for increased height for the main building. There were a couple of areas of the building that exceeded the 32 feet. Not the entire building, but a few areas, and those areas, I think it was up to 45, and the council did grant that special exception.
Okay. Anything specific that you want to hear from the Snyderville Planning Commission, or just make sure that we're, again, headed in the right direction?
Mostly we'd like to get feedback from the commission regarding these new designs and the new drawings, and then we will move forward, you know, with just the next step in the process, which is to get it to a place where it can be approved.
Okay. Hey, Ray, thanks for your time this morning. Well, there have been a number of recent changes to the Park City and Summit County Transportation Program. In the studio with a monthly update, I have Caroline Rodriguez from Summit County. Good morning, Caroline.
Good morning.
So let's start with the Summit e-bike share. I see a bunch of them out and about. Any idea how popular they are?
So to put it into perspective, we are approaching Paris and Montreal usage levels. We are so pleased and have been blown away by the demand for the bikes. We've had almost 15,000 miles ridden and over 4,000 trips, which is the equivalent of about 15,000 kilograms of carbon emissions saved.
So they're working, but you've got signs up on some of the kiosks, so you've got definitely some issues.
Oh, yes, of course. There's always kinks with emerging technologies that we're working on. I think two of our biggest obstacles, aside from the demand for the bikes, number one, we've had some communication issues with the bikes, and I think that's just related to cell coverage. Not quite sure, trying to figure that out. So if it says a bike's available, but then you get there and a bike's not available, it's very frustrating. We're working on that. The other issue is just related to the demand for the bikes. I mean, we were not expecting this many miles to be ridden right off the bat. So things that are routine maintenance like flat tires, servicing brakes, those are coming up a lot more quickly, and we're trying to keep up with that. We actually just added a third full-time logistics person last week, and a fourth will be coming in. So we're working really hard to mitigate some of those maintenance issues.
So, and you and I have talked about mm-hmm. this, but yeah, I definitely had some issues, and I was coming from the Prospector Station. There is no kiosk where you can just stick your credit card in.
Correct.
That makes a big difference. I mean, it was so complicated, and it was, you know, they kept asking for a tag or a pass, and it was like, mm-hmm. what pass? So I still couldn't figure it out, but I have since now registered and have a tag that I hang on my key ring to use. But mm-hmm. why didn't we put a kiosk in all of the stations?
Yeah, so there were a few reasons for that. Specific to Prospector, it was a neighborhood station. So in trying to fit as many stations as we could into our budget, we decided to use that just as a wayfinding station with the hope that people would, since it was a neighborhood station, people would have the app and be annual members and wouldn't need a payment kiosk. You know, with the feedback we've gotten, we have the option to revisit and add payment kiosks at any location that we choose. So that's something that we could consider.
But it's more expensive, and then you have the upkeep of.
Exactly. And, you know, there was a little bit of worry about, because it was a neighborhood location, would the payment screen somehow cause lighting that people weren't, that people wouldn't like? I mean, there was a few issues that went into that at Prospector.
And that was another issue that I had, because it was, it only gave me the option to be an annual member. I didn't want to be an annual member. Mm-hmm. I just wanted a one-time ride, and that was, it was just really undoable.
And I think, you know what, I think if we could go back, hindsight being 2020, we sort of would have rethought that, and maybe even for those neighborhood locations, perhaps given out some trial codes so people could do the one-time ride before signing up right away. Although we have had people that were so excited they did sign up right away, but we should have given out those one-time rides so people could try out the system before they joined.
Okay. So what are the next steps with this? I mean, are you going to have to bring more bikes on, or?
We're definitely going to have to bring more bikes on. We're already planning for that. As you know, we were the recipients of the Tiger Grant, so we're trying to get that grant agreement signed and in place to put in more stations. We will be revisiting the launch data and looking at where the bikes are most in demand. Right now, that has switched from the Park Avenue station to New Park Plaza for both check-in and check-out. As people have said, they go by the stations and they're completely empty because the bikes are all checked out. So an additional bike purchase is a huge consideration for us.
Yeah. How are you getting the bikes back to where they need to be?
So that's part of what our logistics team does. They redistribute the bikes on a daily basis, looking at where is the highest usage, the highest demand, and then they physically pick them up in a trailer and move the bikes to the correct location.
Yeah. So any incidents that you can report on? I mean, people are being careful because many of them do not have helmets.
Yes. So it is not a law in Utah that you need to wear a helmet. So we can't require people to wear helmets. We ask them to wear helmets. If you are in need of a helmet and cannot afford a helmet, please contact myself or Alfred or the Summit County Health Department. We are proponents of wearing helmets, although it's not required. I have not had any specific reports of incidents. I know people are concerned about kids under 18 riding. You do need to be 18 to rent and ride a bike. Parents, please respect that rule and don't rent for your kids if you know they're under 18. And, you know, you still need to obey the laws of the road. It's just like a regular bicycle. You still need to be a respectful rider. Pay attention to what's going on around you.
Then what happens this winter? Do they just sit in the snow?
So in the winter, the stations remain and they're covered, but the bikes are removed for maintenance and upgrade.
Okay, so they won't be available this winter.
They will not be available January through March. And I actually believe in Park City municipal boundaries, there are two or three stations that will actually be removed just because they're in snow storage areas. But then they'll be put back after March.
Okay, let's get a quick update on the Camas commuter route. What are you seeing in terms of riders there?
Yeah, so we're seeing between 40 and 55 riders a day on that route. And I'm so pleased. It's, again, blown away by the usage. Thank you so much to everyone who's giving it a shot and finding it works for their commute.
Yeah. And we had a caller during the forum asking us if this was going to be continued now year round.
Yes.
Will it be increased then this winter?
We are hoping to increase to 7 days a week in the winter. That is something we're working on budget wise and planning wise.
And again, we've got kind of two in the morning and two in the evening. Is that how it's working?
Three in the morning, three in the evening. Yep.
All right. And what are you hearing from users? I mean, do they need different times or those times seem to be
working? So I think the biggest feedback we're getting is please stop in the Black Rock Ridge area, which is something we're working on. Finding an appropriate location for a bus to turn around. It is some private ownership. So thinking about who we're going to contact to get that permission. But I think, yeah, that's the greatest feedback we've had is that Black Rock Ridge location.
Okay. And any other future additions to that then other than another stop?
We might think about adding additional runs, you know, during the week or maybe even on the weekends, especially for resort workers.
Okay. And that's taking people to the hospital? Is that where they're going?
You can go to the hospital and then continue on into town, or you can connect to a waiting vehicle to come into Kimball Junction.
Okay. So where does it bring you into town?
Into town, it stops in front of the high school and then into the transit center, Old Town Transit Center.
And then goes back out.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. The Kimball Junction Circulator, these are the small kind of hotel vans, if you would. And people just flag these down. How are you seeing use on those?
Yeah, so we've had over 600 rides since launch, averaging 60 passengers per day. I am hearing from our drivers that the afternoons are busiest for a mix of people just going to lunch and running errands and especially connecting from the Electric Express. Our morning riders are mostly workers working in the Redstone New Park area or at Tanger Outlets.
Okay. So tell us how that works. You just stand on a curb and...
Yep. As the van says, wave me down for a ride. You just stand on the curb or in a safe place and flag down the rider when flag down the driver when you see the van coming. Eventually, we hope to incorporate it into the MyStop app so you know exactly when the van is coming. But right now, since it runs, you know, every 15 minutes, there's a pretty good chance you're not going to be standing around for long.
Yeah. So how many vans do you have? Just one?
Two vans circulating in opposite directions.
Okay. And then the route is what?
The route, from the transit center, then it goes Redstone Center Drive, circles through Highland Drive, and then back out over by Wendy's. It hits the transit center twice, actually, during its run, because that's a really important connection. Then it will go past the new Whole Foods location and into Tanger and back to the transit center.
Okay. And that map's online?
You can go to our website, summitcounty.org, and then look for the transportation department, and it's there.
Okay. And then with the Electric Express, I see... lots of empty buses, but I know people are using it because I hear them talking about it. And then, of course, we have Arts Festival and it's packed.
Yes, of course. They're always packed during major events. We know people are using the Electric Express on a daily basis, especially the feedback from the circulator that people are connecting using the Express. That's pretty positive for us.
Yeah. Do you have any numbers there, though, in terms of what you're seeing?
I don't have the updated numbers, but I would say 2,000 a day is probably pretty accurate, if not more.
All right. And then what about bikes on the buses? I know you have racks on the front, but I have a bike that's too heavy for me to lift. So are they allowed on the bus?
They are allowed on the bus at the discretion of the driver. If the driver feels it's safe and the bike can fit and it's not going to be a moving projectile, they can let you bring your bike on the bus.
Okay. And then there were some issues about people parking at Walmart to use the bus. Is that... you guys hearing any more problems with that?
So I had actually gone over to Walmart to investigate that, and the manager at Walmart told me not an issue at all for him. So I'm still keeping an ear to the ground to see what's going on, but I have not had that feedback.
Okay. Anything else you wanted to mention?
Nope. Just thanks again to everyone who's made all of our efforts such a huge success.
Okay. Caroline, thanks. 8:34, good morning. Well, the Park City Summit County Arts Council has posted a survey link on its website looking for input on what residents love about local arts and culture and how we can improve it. In the studio with an update on the effort is the director of the Arts Council, Hadley Dynett. Good morning.
Good morning, Leslie.
So let's see. It's on the website, as I mentioned, pcscarts.org under the Project ABC link. What is it that you're looking for here with the survey?
Okay, well, just to back up a little bit, Project ABC stands for Art, Beauty, Culture. And this is a collaborative community-wide cultural planning project to look at the future of arts and culture in Summit County. The goals are to develop a set of collective priorities and action steps that will benefit the entire county, so Park City, Snyderville Basin, as well as North and South Summit. And we've got this broad coalition of individuals that have come together to lead the effort, folks from the business community, the city and the county, nonprofit sector, creatives, philanthropic sector. So they're really providing guidance and insight into how we're structuring it, and the Arts Council is managing the project. We've spent the summer up until now and continuing into the fall kind of on a sprint to collect data, generate ideas, and do a lot of community outreach. And the survey is part of that. You can find it through the pcscarts.org website, as you mentioned, or you can just go directly to the Project ABCSC.com website. It's right there on the homepage. And it takes about 10 minutes to complete. We really are looking for input from everyone from the community, whether you see yourself as a creative or not. I think it's really important to collect information about what we love about our arts and culture environment, as well as identify needs, wants, and opportunities for the future.
So what have you seen in terms of numbers? Do you have a count on...
Yeah, so we've got a number of ways to engage in the project. We launched, as you know, with a pledge, which is essentially a virtual high five for people who want to say that they're advocates for arts and culture, and an intentional investment in planning for this project. We have about 1,000 people that have done that so far, and we're encouraging people to still do that. That's in the pledge button on our website. The survey just launched about a week and a half ago, and so far we have about 100, 120. We've been doing a lot of tabling and outreach at our events, and appreciate the opportunity to come on and tell the community about it today.
Okay. So when will you have the results? I mean, you'll run this through when?
We're going to run the survey into the fall, and then we haven't set kind of a cutoff date. We're really looking at what the numbers are going to be. You know, our kind of target is around 800, so we have a ways to go, but I think we've got a good start. At the end of October, beginning of November, we're going to hold a community convening that will be really the first time that all the people that have participated in the project so far will come together. We have a steering committee and work groups, and the general public will be invited. And it'll be a work session where we'll share back what we found and validate results and look at action planning for the future.
So how are all those results going to be used then to define these actions,
yeah,
future
exactly,
actions?
Exactly.
Yeah. You know, as I kind of went through the survey, it kind of gave me the impression somehow that arts and culture is somehow deficient here. But it doesn't feel that way to me.
Not at all. No, I think that our arts and culture sector is incredibly vibrant. And, you know, well, two things. One is that the project has taken an intentionally broad look at arts and culture. So a lot of times when we think about arts and culture, we think about our performances and our film and our visual arts scene, which is incredible. But we're also looking at things like the county fair and public art and arts education and how arts and culture can be used as a community development strategy. So really thinking broad. I would say that's the first thing, is trying to, you know, look at all the different ways that arts and culture can inform our community priorities. And I think that means things like, how does arts and culture affect new community development and public space planning? How do we tie arts and culture into affordable housing developments? How do we think about arts and culture when we're thinking about transportation development and, you know, ridership? And how can we use art and culture to increase and influence those goals?
Yeah. So are you hearing from the art organizations that perhaps, I mean, even though we may be like on steroids with arts and culture during the summer months, that it's the funding that's somewhat anemic then? Or you haven't necessarily heard that?
I think we're still in the data collection and listening phase. One of the early things that we're hearing, for example, from the creative community, so the artists and the creative entrepreneurs, is the need for more collaboration, the need for spaces to come together and work and show their collections. We're hearing from the nonprofits themselves the idea of speaking collectively as one voice. So those are a couple of, you know, the very, very early findings, and I think that's why it's so important that we get a representative sample of people's perspectives from across the community.
Okay. Again, people can give you more information just by going on the website. What was the Project ABC?
ProjectABCSC.com.
Okay. Anything else, Hadley, you wanted to mention?
No, thanks for having me. I look forward to coming back and sharing more.
Okay. Talk to you next month. KPCW News Time now, 8:41. Good morning, I'm Leslie Thatcher. Well, the Christian Center of Park City gearing up for its annual Back to Basics program. In the studio with details, I have Pete Stoughton. Good morning, Pete.
Good morning.
So what is it that you're doing?
That's right. This Friday, we are doing our Back to School Basics, and we have 550 children here in Park City. That's just half of the total free and reduced lunch children, who we will be providing $100 gift cards to shop for brand new school clothes for the school year.
Okay. So what kind of help are you looking for?
We are looking for just help in raising that money so that we can provide those gift cards for the kids. And 100% of those proceeds that we raise go directly towards the kids.
Okay. So how do people contribute?
We'd love it if they go onto our website and they can click on the link that says Back to School Basics and sign up there to sponsor a kid or two. And in fact, Tanger Outlets has agreed to match $200 donations or more, up to $5,000. So,
okay, so yeah. There's double your money. Yeah.
Yeah, double your money, double your fun.
Yeah. So. But you've already committed to these 550 kids, so they're going regardless.
We're going to make it happen, but yeah. It would be great if we had the community rally around it. So, yes.
Okay. And again, who are the recipients, you say, are kids that have been identified on the free and reduced lunch program? And then
That's right.
from them, how did you pick these kids?
Well, it was first come, first serve. So we did have some registration days, and we've unfortunately had to tell probably about 100 kids that unfortunately we can't sponsor them. So the wait list is pretty long. So.
Okay. And what, do they come with a note from their parents or their parents come shopping with them? I mean, in terms of what they need rather than what they want?
Yeah. What they do is they come actually to our event over at Tanger Outlets, and they've got a little sign-up card. They trade that in for some gift cards, and then we have a bunch of volunteers, and we're still always looking for more volunteers to come and shop with the kids and the families. And it's more of a personal shopper, just someone to help hold items, count up money, make sure that they're purchasing school clothes, because a lot of times the stores might have leftover summer options when we're looking now on this beautiful fall day in August, so looking towards winter. So
okay, so there's somebody to kind of make sure that they're getting the stuff that they probably should get.
Encouraging it, yes.
Yeah. Okay, let's see. People, again, can just take care of this all online with whether a donation or volunteering or...
Yeah, the big thing we're looking for right now is donations. We're about less than a week away, and we still have a little gap that we need to cover. And volunteers come out before school and starts and volunteer.
Okay. Any updates on the building addition and remodel?
We're getting really close. We did some final walkthroughs with our team, and drywall's up. It's just finishing touches, so we're really excited.
Yeah, and I know that then you're going to remodel the existing building once you move into the other building. Does that mean you'll be back in the building for this winter's dinners?
We won't be back in that building again. We're going to partner up and see what fits again, either with the public library or figure out what's best for those winter dinners, yeah.
Okay, anything else?
That's it for us.
Okay. Yeah. Hey, Pete, thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
Well, if you love the blues, you don't want to miss this week's performance of blues singer and guitarist John Mayhol performing for four nights only at the historic Egyptian Theater. He joins me now on the phone. Good morning.
Good morning.
So where do we even begin to start with the 5 minutes we've got to talk about you and your career that has spanned now more than 50 years? I mean, what would you like people to know about yourself, John?
Well, I hope they'll come to the show. That's the main thing, you know, because we've got a great show for you. There's a lot of it's a different show each night, so anybody who wants to come and get a second helping, they'll get a different set list. So, you know, we have a lot of stuff to choose from, as you can imagine, after all these years.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. But some of the hits, I'm guessing you'll do a reprieve of each night, or?
Say what?
I said some of the more well-known hits you'll do maybe a reprieve of each night.
Well, I don't really have any hits, but, you know, there's a lot of material. I try and put together a different set every night that would include stuff from the old days and certainly stuff from the new album, talk about that, and, you know, just make it a well-rounded experience for everybody.
Yeah. Who have you got bringing with you?
Well, we're a trio now. This is two guys from Chicago, Greg Arzab on bass guitar and Jay Davenport on drums.
Okay. Tell me a little bit about the new album. That's how recent?
Well, it's another studio album, and we had a very nice visit from Joe Walsh, who played on a couple of tracks. That was a bit of a surprise to me. And, you know, it was just a very nice... nice session altogether. The whole album took 3 days to make, and you know, we'd like to do it, get that live feeling to it, and I think people will find it very exciting.
Yeah, now the promotion that the Egyptian Theater is doing for you calls you a pioneer of blues music, earning the title the Godfather of British Blues. So how are the British blues different from the American blues or any other blues?
Well, I think it's just a title just really to bestowed on the British musicians rather than British music, British interpretation. So, you know, it's just been hacked around for as long as I can remember, you know, but, you know, just referring to the British blues movement of the 60s, which has stood the test of time.
Yeah. And you're close to my mom's age, and I know that she couldn't keep up with you, especially at 7,000 feet. So, how is it that you're able to keep it up? I guess just doing what you love, huh?
Well, I just don't feel like 83, so just it's business as usual. You know, as long as I've got the energy to give a great show, that's all that's important.
Yeah, so you're doing a tour of the states here? I mean, or is this just kind of a one-time weekend deal for you? Or?
Well, all the dates are always posted on our website, johnmayall.com, so people can look at that. But we do 100 shows every year, so everything's listed on there for people to look at.
Okay. Again, John Mayall performing Wednesday through Saturday nights at the Egyptian Theater, showtime 8 o'clock each night. Tickets are a bit reduced for Wednesday and Thursday nights, starting at $29, parkcityshows.com. And I'm playing, going to go out with this, with the song that I remember first hearing about John Mayall. That's Room to...
First of all, it's Mayall. There's no H in there.
Mayall. First song that I remember hearing you and your group playing. So look forward to having you in town, John.
All right, great. We'll be looking forward to seeing you. Okay, bye.